Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly dive into the issues that shape, shake, and shift our everyday lives. From classrooms to courtrooms, headlines to hallways, we unpack what matters to teens, parents, educators, and other interested folks. For years, we have talked about teen risk behaviors. We focused on vaping and alcohol, social media, and opioids. But today, there's another behavior quietly embedding itself into youth culture: gambling. From sports betting apps advertised during every major game, to influencers posting big wins, to friendly bets among classmates, gambling has been rebranded as entertainment. Events like the Super Bowl are no longer just about football. They're about parlays and prop bets and point spreads. And for many young males in particular, betting is becoming part of identity and social bonding. Some experts now call it the new teen epidemic. Joining me, and I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, on 411 Teen, by the Zoom platform, I welcome Michael Zwill. He's in New York, and he is a licensed clinical social worker and director of clinical outreach at Newport Healthcare. Michael, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Liz.
Well, thanks so much for coming. You have some information that is really invaluable, and I think everybody needs to hear about it. Usually, when people hear teen gambling, they may picture, I don't know, a poker game in a basement. Would you share, what does teen gambling actually look like in 2026?
Yeah, so I think the big thing, Dr. Liz, is, you know, just how it's kind of shifted from more of what we typically think of as like casino gambling and things like that, and how it's so easily accessible on smartphones. So when you think of teens specifically and you know, just the topic of gambling, it's not just card games in the basement of their parents' house. It's, you know, fantasy sports. It is, you know, built into video games these days. It is, as you mentioned in, you know, your intro, you know, Super Bowl, you know, how we're betting, gambling on coin flips, you know, 50-50 chance, heads or tails. So it's super diverse as far as how individuals are engaging in it. But, you know, ultimately the overall goal for many of these teens and even the adult is really that hit of dopamine that they're getting when they're engaging in whatever type of sports betting or gambling they're doing.
You know, I think in preparation for the today's program, I read, and I keep going, maybe I read it wrong, but I read that an estimated 60 to 80% of high school students had reported gambling at least once. Is that accurate or is that overstated?
No, I think that's pretty spot on. And that's, you know, assuming that people are being kind of fully forthcoming and honest about, you know, engaging in the different stuff. So I would say that's a very appropriate stat. There's actually another statistic that's very interesting, that about 90% of bets are being placed on mobile devices. So again, it just goes to show you that, you know, back in the day when you'd have to physically get to a casino or mm-hmm. some kind of, you know, venue like that, that's no longer a need anymore. I mean, you can access things 24/7 on your yeah. phone, and obviously teens and even children, for that matter, mm-hmm. have access to those types of devices these days.
And I think that kind of leads into answering my question next, because I was going to ask you exactly what has changed culturally and legally that's accelerated this normalization.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the big thing is, as you said, Dr. Liz, it's become a normalized part of our culture, especially youth culture. So there, again, there's been a shift from casinos to smartphones, which has increased mm-hmm. access. You know, and what we're also seeing is in males, especially, there's been a huge impact yes. Regarding sports betting. So, you know, you yes. had kind of spoke about, again, the Super Bowl before. That's been a big thing that we've seen with the male specifically. When you talk about legalization, I mean, I don't know the laws for all of the different states, but I know for New York, we saw a huge shift in how this impacted teens around 2021, 2022, when there was the legalization of the sports betting. That was a huge thing that opened a gigantic door, and how it's impacted the youth specifically on Long Island and New York, you know, directly. And I would imagine many other states that, you know, have similar timelines, they probably saw very similar impacts. You know, but even when teens are not legally placing bets, you know, themselves, they participate in informal betting with friends. Mm-hmm. So again, this could be the fantasy sports. This could be different things like that. And as I said, it's becoming a very normalized part of life, which essentially ends up blurring the line between what's entertainment and what is true risky behavior.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. I wanted to touch a little bit more on the young males and why are young males particularly vulnerable. I think I read that rates are 2 to 3 times higher in males than females. Yeah. Although females, I know, I read were increasing, but the young males are just overwhelmingly, you know, 2 or 3 times higher.
Wow. Yeah. So, and you hit the nail on the head, Dr. Liz. We're seeing a little bit of an increase in females as well, but I think especially males. I think a lot of it has to do with what we're gambling on and what we're betting on. Very often sporting events, you know, fantasy sports, which, you know, typically historically is seeing, you know, higher numbers of males than females in that regard as far as an audience. So I think that's a big part of it. I think just, you know, in general with adolescent males, especially the tendency of being impulsive, of course, as we know for both, you know, females and, you know, adolescent males, the brain is developing until like the mid-20s or so. So just automatically you couple that with the fact that young males tend to be very impulsive. They tend to be, you know, kind of risk, you know, seeking in that sense, you know, as far as looking for things that are going to give them that dopamine hit. And, you know, again, the accessibility to gambling and you know, things like that tend to be very intriguing for males, I think.
Okay. Because, you know, that's another question I wanted you to further explore. Just what is happening neurologically in the teen brain that makes gambling so appealing? And it's that release of dopamine, that feel-good neurotransmitter. That gambling hooks you, gets you hooked, and then you get reinforced, and then it keeps on and it keeps on. So I don't know if you want to add to that what I was saying, because I think it's really important that folks understand that. And when you talk about gambling, it's becoming an addiction, and it is and can be an addiction. People tend to think that gambling addiction is different than smoking addiction, is different than, you know, drug addiction. And would you talk about that? Because gambling addiction is similar to substance addiction.
It is. Yeah, Dr. Liz. And, you know, you could even, you know, a lot of the conversation, you know, because I speak a lot on just the impact of gaming in teens as well, gaming, social media, of course. So all of these different things, I feel like you can kind of plug in the blank with any of those types of things, substance use, the video gaming, the gambling, all of those different things. And I think what it comes down to is similar to what we were talking about before, the fact that the brain is still developing until around the mid-20s. So you look at an adolescent brain, you know, and why it tends to be a little bit more impulsive, why it tends to be, you know, dopamine seeking in that regard. And it's because that part of the brain, that limbic part of the brain, is developing before the prefrontal cortex. Pardon me. So, you know, you look at something like the limbic system, which is all about wanting to feel good, wanting to do things that are pleasurable, fun, and you don't kind of have like that quote unquote parent part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, to kind of say like, don't do that. So I think ultimately with teens, you know, they're so susceptible to these types of things, gambling, substance use, all of those different types of things. Because again, you know, when you're seeking that enjoyment, there's not that part of the brain that adults have that says, okay, enough is enough. You just dropped $500 on this bet, you know, maybe close up shop. You know, for kids, they just kind of keep going. You know, the interesting thing, because, you know, this is a very, I guess, you know, kind of sort of controversial, you know, what is video game addiction truly an addiction? Is gambling, you know, all of these different things. And I think a lot of it is, you know, there's not necessarily a detox per se, but, you know, when you talk about it, the addiction quality, and even dare I say some of the detox-like symptoms of the irritability that comes through, the difficulty functioning in day-to-day life. You know, you might see teens that engage in gambling no longer showing up to school. You know, you do start to see very similar, you know, things to somebody maybe struggling with substances as far as those diagnostic criteria.
Well, what about, we didn't talk much about this, the reinforcement in gambling is a little different. I mean, it's really intermittent rewards. And that's what seems to be so powerful. Whereas with the substance abused, you know, every hit is a reinforcement. So talk to the listening audience about that. The intermittent reinforcement.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head, Dr. Liz. I think ultimately what it comes down to is that is super enjoyable because, you know, it's like that, you know, Forrest Gump quote, you know, life is like a box of chocolates, you never know what you're going to get type of a thing. So when you're gambling, you're hitting that button and you don't know, this could be the time when you're winning or this could be the time that you lose. And when you lose it, it's all right, I'll get it next time. And always this, you know, never ending cycle of you never know what you're going to get type of a thing, which is extremely intriguing, especially for teens, even for adults, of course. Mm-hmm. So you look at things I had kind of mentioned before that I think video games sometimes kind of prime, you know, young children and teens to kind of get used to the feeling that you get with gambling. You look at things in video games like loot boxes and mm-hmm. what they call gacha pulls and different things like that, randomized, you know, rewards within games. It's all of these feelings that are giving them that dopamine hit. And then that's a very easy shift to eventual bigger, you know, real life gambling versus just the video game stuff.
Can gambling prime the brain for other addictive behaviors? I know that's been a debate, and I thought, like,
And Dr. Liz, you're starting to see more people write about that and some different research coming out on that, you know, because it's kind of like what came first, the chicken or the egg type of a situation. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, ultimately from what I've seen just in my experience of working with teens and young adults specifically, like, you know, a lot of these things do sometimes indicate that, you know, individuals perhaps could develop, you know, struggles later in life, whether it be, you know, with more intense gambling, whether it be, you know, substance use addiction, whatever it might be. You know, there's definitely some, you know, conversations happening about, you know, all of these different things kind of priming individuals to develop perhaps bigger and more concerning issues as they get older.
Let me ask you, when do we see this? I mean, I know a lot of young people report their first exposure during, I guess, middle school or before age 14. Is that mm-hmm. what you're seeing? Would you agree with that or is that off?
With regards to gambling,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say that's pretty accurate. I think, you know, ultimately a lot of what I have seen, generally you're looking at between the ages of like 16 to 22 when things become really pronounced as far as developing gambling problems. That being said, to your point, we're seeing more individuals getting introduced earlier on. And uh-huh. that's why things that tend to be seen as more of the, dare I say, low risk type things, when in reality, I think they are.
Hold your thoughts. You know, hold your thoughts first. Please hold your thoughts for a second, and we'll get back to that. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and we are having a very informative discussion on gambling in teens. Tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and parents, educators, and other interested folks. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and we are talking today about gambling in teens. Michael, did I interrupt you, or did you finish your thoughts? Was there anything else you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, the only thing I was going to add to that, Dr. Liz, is, you know, as I mentioned, 16 to 22 tends to be that window for the highest risk of developing gambling, you know, issues as they get older. But, you know, to your point, individuals that are younger than 16 are certainly being introduced to this and, you know, things like fantasy sports and things like that.
Okay. How does stress, and I'm thinking with teens, how does stress and anxiety increase their vulnerability?
Yeah. So I think, you know, ultimately, as with many forms of addiction, you know, oftentimes people are trying to find an escape. So you look at somebody who's highly stressed, you know, very anxious in different situations, you know, once you find that thing that kind of lights you up in a good way, people sometimes will really grasp onto that, they really lock into that. So, you know, unfortunately, when you see individuals struggling with anxiety, a lot of times for teens, at least, that might look like not going to school or going to school and kind of being very isolated. And then all of a sudden kind of feeling like alive, rejuvenated when you're doing things like, you know, gambling or playing video games that kind of have those intermittent rewards, as we spoke about before. So I mm-hmm. think, as with many things, I mean, you could talk about somebody who might be depressed, but certainly with anxiety and stress in general, it's a great way, quote unquote, great way for individuals to sometimes get that release that can eventually become more, unfortunately, habitual and more problematic.
Gambling often is framed as a skill rather than a choice. Would you address that?
Yeah. So, you know, I've worked with a lot of individuals that kind of really mm-hmm. feel like they have a system and that, mm-hmm. You know, they can, you know, this is what gets people into trouble sometimes. Mm-hmm. So they're down $500 and they turn around and say, I know how I can win it back. And then 500 turns into 1,000 and so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, I mean, yes, are certain people more knowledgeable when it comes to gambling, you know, card games, different things like that than others? For sure. Yet at the end of the day, it's still gambling, you know, it's still a chance. So, you know, that's the thing. I mean, yes, are there certain people that are a little bit more skilled than others? Of course. Yeah. But at the end of the day, it's not an exact science, unfortunately. And that's why, you know, sometimes people get themselves in trouble.
We've touched on, you know, the impact of social media, but would you address for the parents that are listening particularly, how social media amplifies the whole narrative with the big wins and kids being very, very tuned in to social media and what it has to say and making sure that they are fitting in?
Yes. So I think first and foremost, the important thing to point out with social media is oftentimes people are not posting the videos where they lost a grand, they lost $500, whatever it might be. No. They're going to post that 1 out of 15 videos where they hit the jackpot for $1,000. So, you know, I think ultimately in all forms of social media, not just gambling, like you're seeing people when they are dolled up and looking their best versus when they're sitting on the couch in their sweatpants. So a lot of times, mm-hmm. you know, social media, of course, creates this very unrealistic expectation of life. But essentially, social media plays a huge role with regards to influencers and sports personalities, of course. And nearly half of the teens, there's another stat, nearly half of teens who gamble report seeing gambling-related content on social media. So again, these are individuals that are seeing glorified, you know, situations where people are, you know, hitting big jackpots, things of that nature. I know I kind of spoke a little bit before, you know, about how video games does, you know, kind of impact that. And video games is kind of a form of social media as well. But that I think is the biggest thing. Social media is creating this unrealistic expectation. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. It doesn't create like the exact picture of what to expect if you go down that road of gambling and how it can become very problematic, very dark, unfortunately.
Well, do you feel that teens are gambling to escape emotional discomfort, to escape whatever is bothering them?
Yeah, I think some may, Dr. Liz. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. there definitely are those people that kind of find solace in gambling and kind of, you know, get that reward part of their brain lit up, whereas, you know, in other areas of their life, they can't. I also think there's going to be the large cohort of people that turn around and say, it's more of a social thing. Like, you know, I mm-hmm. don't have a problem. I'm mm-hmm. not doing it because I need to. It's because, you know, my friends and I like doing fantasy sports and we like to potentially win something. So all of us throw $50 on the season type thing. So I think you're going to get a big response. But I think ultimately for many people with regards to gambling, it is checking the box for them mm-hmm. in one way or another. And what I would say is, you know, to do away with that, to try and create healthier balance in a person's life, it's figuring out what's going to fill that void. Because oftentimes, if that is their main way of socializing with friends or whatever it might be, generally, you're going back to what you know best. And that could be social media, that could be gambling, that could be, you know, substance use, whatever it might be, you're generally going back to what you know best. So I think, yes, there are some that a chunk of people that will turn around and do this because it really is giving them what they need in that moment. And then there's going to be other people that view it more as a social thing. And unfortunately, they do it more than they maybe should, and it mm-hmm. become problematic financially for them.
Now, you are with Newport Health Center. And if I understand it correctly, provides residential outpatient mental health treatment for, I guess, tweens, teens, and young adults. Just tell us a little bit about that. I always like to know, you know, like for my guests to share where they are and what they're doing.
Oh, I appreciate that, Dr. Liz. Yeah, so Newport Healthcare, we treat the littles, we call them. So we go as young as 7 years old, and we go up to the age of 35. So really, we are seen as a child and adolescent, as well as young adult residential program, you know, treating predominantly mental health, substance use related disorders, as well as OCD primary. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what we also see for, you know, the little kiddos, the 7 year olds, all the way up to the age of 35 is what we consider to be process addictions as well. So we see a lot of individuals coming to us for an unhealthy balance with, you know, video games, unhealthy balance with tech in general, mm-hmm. you know, things of that nature, eating disorders. So that's a lot of what we do. And really, I mean, predominantly the program is structured to help individuals find their authentic selves, to have them come in, to give them top quality clinical care, introduce them to a lot of different experiential therapies so that hopefully, you know, when they do come to leave us and return home, they now can take those transferable skills with them and fill that void with stuff that really fills them up versus kind of depletes them.
Okay. Now, where are you located? I mean, you all have various satellite locations, correct? Or am I not?
We do. No, you're spot on, Dr. Liz. So we're kind of, you know, stretched out across the United States. We really kind of identified where a lot of need has been historically. And we have a lot of programs in those relatively immediate areas. So generally, we're on the West Coast. We're on the northern part of the country in Minnesota, several in the middle part of the country, and then up and down the East Coast as well.
Okay. When does gambling, casual betting, let's put it that way, when does casual betting cross over into problematic behavior? I mean, would you share some of the early warning signs? What are some of the signs that parents might, you know, pick up on? Because gambling can be that invisible addiction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So to answer that question, Dr. Liz, what I would say first and foremost, one of the first signs you're going to want to kind of look into or you know, explore is when your teen might be very secretive around money or online activity, especially when it comes to sport scores or betting discussions, things of that nature. Typically, as with many other things, you're looking for sudden changes in mood around games or outcomes. You know, they might be a little bit more irritable if their team loses, might be a little bit more frustrated. And, you know, some of this, I mean, you chalk it up to, you know, hey, I'm a Mets fan. When the Mets lose, I get upset. It's kind of like the extremes that I'm talking about where, you know, maybe they're a little bit more upset than they generally are. Parents might notice their child asking for money more, you know, perhaps borrowing from their friends or vague about where their money's going. You know, so things of that nature, I would say, are kind of like the initial precursors of a discussion should probably happen. Not that we necessarily have to assume the worst, but, you know, this warrants a little bit more exploration from a parent. And, you know, sometimes maybe that's a great opportunity to kind of loop in somebody that is a professional in this area, where if you are noticing some of those changes in your team's behavior or behavioral patterns. Does it make sense to maybe have them talk to somebody to explore it? Because even if it's not gambling, there clearly is a shift in that individual's typical baseline.
Do you find that teens may be hiding gambling apps on their phone? Is that something that is happening? Or is that...
Without a doubt. The kids are savvy, I'll tell you, Dr. Liz. you know, they're very savvy when it comes to that stuff. So, you know, yes, to answer your question, I think there is some app, you know, hiding going on. I mean, individuals could use their computers for this. I mean, fantasy sports is not just something you access on your phone. It could be on your laptop, your desktop. So really, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you're, to your point, not always necessarily going to catch your teen in the act of doing it. So it's really kind of being very savvy as far as some of those changes you see, because so often I tell a lot of the parents I work with that, you know, your son or daughter far better than I do. So when you start noticing those little subtle changes, generally parents are pretty, you know, aware of that. And then that's what's going to warrant a more deep discussion.
Do you find that it often correlates with a lot of secrecy and a lot of lying? Is that the case?
Generally, yes. I mean, you know, what I will say is teens tend to be very secretive say it, but they tend to lie just in general. So I think some of this is just, you know what I mean? So I think some of this is just appropriate, but for sure, I think, you know, when a teen is doing something that perhaps they feel like their parents are not going to necessarily agree to, you know, certainly gambling being one of those things, I think you definitely are going to be seeing more of that secrecy, some more of that, those lying type behaviors. And I know this conversation is more related to teens specifically, but, you know, a lot of these are behaviors that you will also see in adults. You know, I work with, you know, a lot of couples, you know, actually where, you know, one of the partners is coming in because they found out that their partner that they've been married to for 40 years has been lying and they lost their mortgage, you know, all the mortgage payments go into gambling, all of these different things. So I think, unfortunately, deceit is somewhat a part of this illness, I guess I would say, that I think is not atypical for adults and, of course, the teens as well.
Well, now, this is kind of a catch-22. Are you seeing high-achieving teens being vulnerable? Because then we have gambling affecting the academic performance. So are you seeing high-achieving teens being involved, or is that not the case? Does it matter?
Yeah, I think it's right across the board, Dr. Okay. Liz, as far as that goes. I mean, you of course see individuals that are really struggling in all areas of their life, which I think makes it, in my opinion, a little bit easier to kind of find stuff sooner, because you see this person clearly struggling in a lot of areas of your life, but then you see the opposite end of the spectrum where, you know, an individual is doing sports, they're excelling in their academics just because they're very naturally bright. Yet they have this very budding, very concerning gambling behavior that's starting to kind of creep in. So those, unfortunately, are the ones that sometimes go, mm-hmm. you know, under the radar, kind of fall between the cracks, because looking at them from an eagle eye view, they seem to have it all together. Mm-hmm. And this is why, I mean, you know, and not to segue away from the topic at hand, but this is why when you bring up the topic of suicide and things like mm-hmm. that, you know, individuals sometimes turn around and say, mm-hmm. we had no idea. Like, she was, you know, top right. cheerleader, you know, biggest person in the concert band, all of these different things. It doesn't make sense. Yet those individuals struggle as well.
Now, are there particular behaviors that you want to emphasize that parents may miss? I mean, we know that we're going to see some behavioral changes. We know their grades may drop. But is there something that you think that parents listening, educators, whomever listening, need to be aware of? And they're not the typical, you know, it's not really what parents typically see, and they kind of overlook that. I mean, for example, when I was reading, they were talking about parents who knew their children were gambling, but they said, you know, it's just a little bit of money. They yep. aren't losing a whole lot. You know what I mean? That was yep. sort of their attitude. Well, they aren't losing that much money. What are you seeing that parents might miss? That's my question.
Well, I think you bring up a great point. I mean, we see this in a lot of different areas. Like, you look at somebody who's maybe using marijuana that's becoming problematic. Sometimes the response from a parent would be, well, it's only marijuana. It could be a lot worse. They're not using mm-hmm. heroin. You know, so it's a lot of like minimizing what's going on. I think ultimately, you know, as we spoke about before, I think there are going to be those individuals. I mean, in my personal opinion, I think, you know, teenagers engaging in gambling behaviors and stuff like that, I think there's probably never a right time. I think it is kind of problematic when individuals mm-hmm. are kind of diving into that level of transaction with money potentially at such a young age. That being said, I think there are likely going to be those people that can do it and be relatively okay. They can, you know, bet $50 a year on their fantasy sports team. And then there's going to be that other side of the spectrum that is a little bit more problematic, a little bit more concerning, and needs to be dealt with a little bit quicker in that regard. Mm-hmm. So what I would say to parents, to answer your question, is to never minimize what's going on, regardless of whether or not it's as severe as the kid up the street. Your child is still experiencing something. You know, they're going through something, whether or not it seems like they have it all together, whether or not it seems like it's not that big of a deal, it's still something to explore, because I think the concern is, you know, and as we kind of spoke about before, the precursors to bigger issues as people get older. I think when you're stoking the dopamine, kind of like looking yeah. for dopamine in areas that are not always the best, yeah. that usually becomes more of a habit forming thing that as you get older, you continue to seek different types of ways to get that dopamine hit that you got when you were 15 and gambling $20 a year on your fantasy sport. So I think it's something to, at the very least, begin to explore at a young age. And you hope that it's never going to be an issue in the future. And you could chalk it up to, hey, we had a conversation and it's done. But I've seen other sides of that where things are not addressed because, you know, we will minimize it. We'll mm-hmm. assume it's not a big deal. And then all of a sudden, the train's going full steam ahead. And now it becomes much harder to course correct.
What about major, like, thousands of dollars? Are you seeing teens do that? And then I'll tell you why I asked. Because I did have one parent who shared with me that their teen was into $15,000 debt and gambling, yep. and they didn't know anything about it. Of course, they had numerous charge cards, and you know they were able to get the money in different ways, and their parents didn't know about it. And then all of a sudden, they just crashed. So, do you see a lot of that, or is that exceptional?
No, very much so. I think, you know, the tough thing, and you mentioned it before with the credit cards, you know, what mm-hmm. I've seen a lot is with individuals doing this online and also within video games where parents have no idea that mm-hmm. their child has the credit card information, and all of a sudden they get the credit card statement and they see it's $2,000, you know, in gambling or whatever. So, you know, without a doubt, I don't think that's atypical. I think likely it's, you know, not always necessarily that high level of severity with teens, just mm-hmm. because I think sometimes the means are limited. Unless they can get stuff from their parents type of a thing. So I think generally with teens, you're not usually seeing their $50,000 in the hole type of a thing. That being said, there are those times where individuals do have access to family means. They have access to selling things to friends, to people, you know, online, and they have a way of getting finances, which unfortunately sometimes could lead to them digging a very deep hole for themselves in that sense.
And that's when we see also the emotional fallout from, you know, the significant losses, and you see the depression, and you see the suicide attempts, and you see the, you know, cutting and hurting of themselves. Is that you? Are you seeing that too?
Absolutely. I think at some point for individuals, Dr. Liz, especially, again, going back to the beginning part of our conversation where kids, you know, teens tend to be very impulsive, I think what ends up happening is you start to develop a very defeatist mentality of it's never going to get better. You know, this hopeless feeling of it's never going to get better. I'm never going to be able to kind of dig out of this. And then unfortunately, sometimes we resort to very extreme measures. And, you know, hopefully someone is there to kind of support and get them the care that they need. But I've certainly seen how this can be something that really snowballs. Because, you know, teens in that moment, even adults in that moment, it can feel very much like there is no way out of this situation, depending on how deep you got into it.
I'd like to take some time for us to talk about or to have you address some of the myths that are associated with gambling, particularly gambling with, you know, within the teen and young adult population. And I think I'm thinking of one, and I'll share it with you, but then we'll probably go on break and we can come back and talk about it. But I've also heard parents say, well, gambling, it's safer than drinking or drugs, because, you know, it's not the same kind of thing. And we know that that's not the case. But hold your thoughts, because we're at that point where I need to take a break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and this hour we are examining teen gambling. Right before we went on break, we were talking about how sometimes folks look at gambling and think that it's not that much of a problem. And Michael, will you address that?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things we kind of spoke about, you know, was just how this impacts teens and how it can very much be problematic. And really, I think some of the concern, as we were talking about earlier, is that this could potentially lead to bigger and more complex things as this particular teen gets older.
Okay. Another one, because I've encountered several of them and I wanted us to at least address them. They say if it's legal, then it must be safe. And of course, we know legalness does not, you know, equal harmlessness. But would you address that one, too? Because I've had parents say, oh, well, it's legal. I mean, it's not like they're engaging in anything that's illegal. So,
yeah. And a couple more. I was, you know, as you were speaking, Dr. Liz, you know, as far as, you know, some other gambling myths, I guess I'd say for adolescents specifically. Big one that I hear from parents and just in general is video games aren't gambling. You know, again, that is something that very much, as I said, kind of primes things, you know, kind of, you know, gives individuals a taste of those intermittent rewards that sometimes makes them seek it in other areas of their lives. So that's a big one. And another myth is that teens will grow out of it. So I think, again, it goes back to our conversation before of, you know, kind of, you know, parents, and I hate to beat up on parents, it's parents and you know, other people in the community as well, that kind of chalk it up to, you know, very, you know, kids are going to be kids. They're going to do dopey things sometimes and they get over it. And I think, yes, you know, sometimes that is certainly the case where, you know, we make a bad decision, we do something we shouldn't do, and we kind of move on from it. But there is also that cohort of teens that will not grow out of this and will need some level of intervention, some level of support. So I would say those are a couple of additional myths. And lastly, I would say just, you know, for teens and adults, I think just the myth that sports knowledge makes gambling safe. You know, I know a lot of people that think there are sure bets on the Knicks and you know, all of a sudden the Knicks lose and now you're out the money. So, you know, it's one of those things where I think going back to your point before, Dr. Liz, as far as, you know, gambling being a skill, yes, I think certain people are more skilled than others, but at the end of the day, gambling is gambling. Nothing is a sure bet. And I think sometimes with sports gambling, people kind of think that they kind of have the system that's foolproof. And unfortunately, we've seen, you know, all too many times that that's not the case.
In this last segment, let's look at parents and the dynamics involved. And what do you suggest? How should parents approach the talk about gambling without shaming their teens, without putting them down? When should this conversation start? Would you address those questions?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, with all areas of mental health and just, you know, teen, you know, support in general, I think coming from a place of genuine curiosity, genuine support is the way to kind of attack it in that regard. And I think the reason I say that is because sometimes I in my experience and no fault of parents, but parents get very scared. They get very uncertain about how to best handle it. And it comes across as very punitive, very aggressive in their initial, reach out to the kiddo. And what ends up happening at that moment is the teen or the child now learns, I cannot bring things to you because this is how you'll react. So I think to answer your question, if there is something that's going on with your teen that has you somewhat concerned as a parent, or just something that's kind of flagging on your radar that, you know, this is something that seems new, I'm a little concerned, it's coming at it from a place of curiosity of, you know, hey, this is something I've noticed. I want to learn more. And I think if you come across that way, it will allow the teen to kind of feel as though you're not coming from it as a place of like hierarchy or punitiveness in that regard. You're coming at it more so from a sense of just wanting to kind of know what's going on and treating it more like a collaborative discussion versus what sometimes happens with parents is kind of that instilling your will.
What about monitoring their betting apps? Do you have any suggestions on how they approach that? Should they just leave that alone? Because that's something that, I mean, I know they do. They try to do using their phones.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a huge fan and a huge proponent, to be very, very honest with you. I mean, I think phones for teens and children especially is a privilege. Mm-hmm. It's not a right in that regard. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, parents having access to things like social media, things like, you know, certainly betting apps, you know, if that's going on, fantasy sports, all that different stuff, like parents should be able to have access to that. I know if there are parents that are listening to this, of course, right now, they're probably thinking that would be World War III if I tried to go through my no. phone type of a thing. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, if there is stuff going on that has you concerned, you know, maybe not necessarily going at it right to that degree of give me your phone, I want to look through it. But, you know, having them talk to somebody and maybe when they're talking to somebody, work in that this is something as your parent that I feel I need to do to kind of keep you safe and to continue to support you and kind of get the support when doing it. Because I've seen all too many times when parents try to take their kiddo's phone, you know, it's one of those things that could escalate very quickly. But again, to my point before, I think it's one of those things where access to apps, you know, visibility of what kids are doing on the phone is extremely, extremely important and something that should happen. I also believe, you know, in phone curfews in that regard. I you know, all too often teens are getting into trouble.
Oh, that's great later to hear you say that. I mean, I couldn't help but that's just perfect.
Oh my gosh, there's a great quote, Dr. Lewis.
I'd like to throw them all away if you want to know the truth.
You and me both. But, you know, there's a great quote, and I'm probably going to butcher it now, but it was something like, you know, you wouldn't allow your child in a questionable part of town at 2 a.m., so why are you giving them access to something that they can go anywhere they want type of a thing? So, again, you know, having some type of a phone curfew in the evening, I think will reduce the likelihood of them getting into things that they shouldn't be getting into. Because, again, all too often with teens, we hear that they're bored at bedtime, they can't sleep, they start doing things impulsively, and then all of a sudden, bam, they're up till 3 a.m. doing whatever they were doing.
Exactly. Well, what about, we didn't talk about this, what about the parent who gambles themselves? How do they frame the conversation, and what kind of role modeling are they establishing?
Yeah. So that's it. You know, I'm a huge fan of you know, practicing what you preach in that regard. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for example, if the expectation at home is no phones at the dinner table, like mom and dad shouldn't be taking their phone out of the dinner table. So I do think, you know, obviously it's kind of being thoughtful of that, like what your kids are being exposed to. You know, at the end of the day, this is never to tell parents what they can and can't do. If parents right. or you know, individuals in general want to get together with their friends on Wednesday night and play poker, you know, they should enjoy themselves. Because again, I don't want to totally turn around and say gambling is bad, you know, things of that nature, that it's all problematic. Because no, there are people that do it very appropriately. There are people that have a very healthy balance, and it ends up becoming a part of their social life that's okay. You know, I think the really, the crux of this conversation is obviously the difference between an adult brain engaging in something like that versus a teen brain that is still developing and could potentially become more problematic. So I think that's kind of the mm-hmm. conversation at hand of, A, how much is that child being exposed to how you're gambling, or you're having friends over every single night and you know, throwing money around, or is it one of those things that you're occasionally doing with friends? Because I think that should be the conversation with the child or mm-hmm. client, whatever you want to refer to them as, you know, depending on your discipline, that, you know, that's a lot of what goes into this. How are the parents doing it? What's the frequency that they're doing it? And kind of understanding the difference between an adult and an adolescent brain.
Well, what about prevention research? What has that shown? Has it indicated anything, any behavior, any activity that might work?
As far as gambling?
So, mm-hmm. I mean, as far as gambling.
For sure. So, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff that's been done. You know, I don't know if there's teachers in schools listening, but, you know, schools have been doing school-based prevention programs. That have been doing a great job, you know, as far as getting in front of peers and students in general. And I think there's something to be said when you're, you know, in something with other students, you know, the student body is just a different level of connection because, you know, you're with other people or peers that you might be engaging in these behaviors with. A family-based prevention, I think, is an important one. A lot of what we do at Newport Healthcare is something called attachment-based family therapy. So very robust family model. And I think, you know, when you do have a teen that might be engaging in things that are a little bit problematic, whether it be gambling, whether it be, you know, substance use, whatever it might be, the data and the research behind family involvement so that they can kind of continue to support that child outside of the therapy sessions, outside of the school setting, is crucial in that sense, because that's a lot of times what we see where a child may go to school and do remarkably well, but they go home and the parents just don't feel equipped to have some of those conversations. So from a prevention standpoint, schools have been doing a great job, and research has really shown the impact that family involvement can have in a child's treatment.
I just have to ask this. I know how I feel. Should gambling carry warning labels like they do with alcohol and cigarettes? Do you think that would be effective?
I do. You know, you always get at the end of the commercials, you know, that they say it like, you know, mm-hmm. this five paragraph thing in like the span of like 2 seconds, they make it really, really sped up. But, you know, they kind of let you know if you have a gambling, you know, issue or however they word it, you know, call this number. So, you know, I think we're going to start seeing more things like that. You know, you're already seeing it come up with social media. You know, obviously there's a lot of things going on with Facebook, Meta, all that stuff. So I think mm-hmm. over the next handful of years, to answer your question, yes, I do think that you're going to start seeing more warning labels on a lot of these different process addictions, because we're seeing that they are concerning, that they do have an impact certainly on kids, but just as on the population as a whole. So I would venture to guess in the next few years, you're going to see more of a pronounced effort to have things like warning labels and really kind of helping people understand that this does not come with no risk. This can be something that's extremely concerning, extremely problematic. And to answer your question, I agree with it. I think mm-hmm. that is something mm-hmm. that should be there, because, you know, people, I think, get into this where it's been very normalized, where they don't see the risk attached to it until it's unfortunately too late.
Well, in these last few minutes, let's address just the treatment and the identification. How is a gambling addiction identified?
Yep. So the DSM 5, you know, mm-hmm. in that regard, they do have, you know, the diagnostic criteria. I won't bore you with that in that sense, but very similar to, as you said before, Dr. Liz, with somebody struggling with substance use. But, you know, from a treatment perspective, you know, there's a lot of data and research behind cognitive behavioral therapy, treating somebody struggling with, you know, gambling. It really is meant to kind of essentially explore the distorted gambling beliefs. You know, as far as what we spoke about before, the intermittent rewards, like I'm due for a win, I can beat the system, like really challenging those mm-hmm. thoughts and helping people manage those urges and those triggers. So that's probably one of the bigger forms of treatment that I'm familiar with and that we do for individuals that might be struggling with process addictions and gambling specifically. There's also motivational interviewing, which is a big one as far as, you know, and I would say for any form of substance use or addiction, pardon me. Mm-hmm. It's great, you know, because generally you're going to be working with individuals that there might be some level of ambivalence about stopping, right. You know, where, you know, it is a little problematic, but at the same time, it's fine. Mm-hmm. So motivational interviewing is a big one, group support, you know, and certainly the family involvement, as I mentioned before, okay. kind of those modalities that are recommended.
What about that teen that is in therapy, is in treatment, but it's not committed to it?
And we see that. We see that all too often.
I'm sure you do.
I mean, it's a rarity. I mean, you know, as we spoke about in this conversation, we're a residential program. So generally individuals are getting to us a little bit later in their treatment tenure, I guess I'd say. But even for just your standard patient therapist, all too often, you know, teens will come and it feels somewhat like an interrogation at first. Like you're getting the one-worded answers. You're not getting the full level of buy-in from a teen. So I would say that's extremely typical. I think, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, not to be cliche about it, but you meet a kiddo where they're at. You know, you try and explore where there might be an opportunity to develop a little bit of a rapport with them, create that level of trust. Because I think many teens, you know, not many teens, but I think there's a good cohort of teens that kind of understand, like, what's happening right now is not good, but they don't necessarily know how to change it. And they may not fully trust the people that are trying to kind of like get overly involved from their perspective. So I think that's a common thing when you're working with teens. I think, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of therapists, a lot of clinicians that start with teens and they realize it's a very challenging population to work with and they break away from that. But the people that stick in at working with teens kind of understand the importance of rapport development, trust development, to really start chipping away things and peel back the layers of the onion.
For the listening audience, because I know they're going to say, you didn't ask this, but I know it's an individual case. How long does recovery take? I mean, can teens really fully recover from this?
Oh, so yes, absolutely. So, you know, it's one of those things, but from a time frame standpoint, it's extremely individualized. And that goes back to, you know, all of the supports that are in place. I tell families all the time, I mean, you know, what I will say, and you know, a little shameless plug, we do great work at Newport. That being said, if individuals come to us and they leave and the discharge plan doesn't make sense or the family's not in a great place, that's when the wheels fall off again. So from like a sustained healing prognosis type of a thing, I think the greatest chance of success, full recovery, you know, relapse prevention, all of that different stuff comes from treating that individual's life as like a system. There's the individual treatment team, there's the psychiatrist, of course, there's the family, there's the school. And kind of having that system around that child is going to give them the greatest chance of success. And I think if that's there, there's no reason to assume otherwise that person couldn't, you know, better manage these types of behaviors, perhaps create a better balance if that's the goal versus abstinence, whatever it might be. But there's certainly no reason it couldn't be a very positive prognosis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there screening tools that you are aware of that pediatricians can use?
You know, pediatricians, I always say pediatricians are the first line of defense in that regard. They see a lot of stuff in their kiddos, and that's generally when they're kind of recommending something else. So, I mean, as far as some gambling screening tools, I mean, for adults, there's the South Oaks Gambling Screen, which is probably one of the more well-known ones, I guess I'd say. There's the Problem Gambling Severity Index, you know, brief biosocial gambling screen. So there are certain things that pediatricians could do. I would say, you know, if there is the gambling stuff going on, I mean, not that it's a bad thing for a pediatrician to kind of explore, but I would recommend and encourage speaking with a clinician, speaking with somebody that is very well-versed in this type of a need in that regard. But those are typically the assessment tools that are done, the South Oaks and, you know, some of those different ones that I mentioned.
In these last couple of minutes, if you could speak directly to parents, what is the one thing you would say to them about teen gambling?
So I would say never treat it as it's no big deal, that they're going to get over it eventually, that, you know, there's worse things they could be getting involved in. The answer to that is yes, there are certainly worse things they could be doing for sure. But I think minimizing it and treating it more as like a, you know, a teenage, whatever you want to call it, like a thing that they're going through in the moment and eventually it's going to break out, I would say is unfortunately something that creates problems down the road. So that's first and foremost. The other thing I always like to say with regards to gambling and just treatment in general, to be very honest with you, or struggles in general, letting parents know that they're not alone. I think a lot of times parents feel as though they're kind of stuck on an island. They don't want to bring up things to the school. They don't know how to seek out treatment options and different things like that. So just kind of letting them know that they're not on their own. This isn't something that they need to kind of deal with on their own island. There are a lot of supports in different areas around the United States. That's what my team and I do. We connect people with different resources, appropriate clinical options. So that's what I would say. Not treating it as a minimizing type of a thing with regards to gambling, that you're giving it the attention that it deserves, and also understanding that this isn't something you have to navigate and figure out on your own. There are a lot of people that are becoming and are very proficient in how to best manage adolescents that might be struggling with this type of a need.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much for sharing your expertise and your time with 411 Team. We really appreciate it. So it's time out for today's edition of 411 Team. Gambling today doesn't look like it did a generation ago. The adolescent brain is uniquely wired for risk and uniquely vulnerable. If you're a parent, coach, educator, the takeaway is awareness and conversations and early intervention. Thanks to Michael Zwell. Much, much appreciation. And much appreciation to my listening audience for your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at WFSU.org.